This is day 6 of the August 92-70 retreat at Springwater. Here are a few things that were talked about. I didn't write down very much. Does anyone ever say how wonderful and pleasant it is here? Many people do say that. Talks are not used usually to revel in good feelings, but to look at what it is that hinders us. Like one person today saying, why am I not happy? To look at our blockages, obstructions, problems in a fresh way, in the midst of a quietly beautiful place. In which great care is given to the outside and inside and to the people who come here. Why does one pick a flower? This came up in a group meeting when somebody had asked whether flower arranging is also meditation, or is there a difference between meditation and arranging flowers? The person said there is not really any difference. And then someone said, why does one pick a flower? And the reaction just comes up in the listener. What is it? Giving reasons, or feeling guilty, or rationalizing, justifying. That's to be looked at, if one is so inclined. Can that all become transparent, our reactions to a question? Our indomitable urge to explain, rationalize, or defend. Can it become transparent? And also, can we just simply listen to a question and look at the question like at a flower? How does one look at a flower? How does one listen to a question? How does one listen to the sound of insects? Right now, where flowers abound in unspeakable beauty and combination of colors, shapes, and sizes, and scents, amidst the grains that have ripened and browned. How does one look at a flower? Whether it's a picked flower in a room, lighting up the table, or in a field, in a wild meadow, how does one look? The person who asked the question said, flowers speak to us, don't they? They're eloquent, not verbally. And very often we look at a flower and there's already a poem about it. Some poem either we make ourselves or we remember a poem and it rattles off in the mind and we don't see the flower. Or there's a possessiveness about it. I want to have this flower. Actually, should remember, as a little girl, I was fascinated by flowers. We took our daily Sunday walk, which I was not so fascinated by because we had to take it. In a park, and of course, you stayed on the roads, on the paths. We were told that if we ran into the meadows, they were not mowed, it was just beautiful meadows, the policeman would get us and take us to the office. And I had heard that one girl had once been taken on the back of the horse behind a policeman to the office and arrested for picking flowers. And there's nothing I wanted more than to pick these little flowers, particularly in spring. Snow drops, Schneeglöckchen, they're called snowbells. A real desire to pick some, bring them home, or make a wreath out of them, or a little bracelet. Sometimes on vacation we could do that. We were told there were no policemen around. Or these little things, I don't know what they're called in this country, look, little tiny little daisies, just as flat as the mowed grass. We call them goose flowers in German. Those we could pick, and it was such a joy at picking a flower. I didn't think it's mine, but there must have been something of that in there, I don't know. Just to keep it, to have it, put it in a vase at home. I noticed our little granddaughter was here not too long ago. She's 6 years old. She loved to pick flowers. Can I pick this? She would ask permission. Usually pull them right off at the flower. In thinking of this, how does one look at the flower? I remember I used to talk when I was still at the Zen Center. During that talk was called Teisho, and one of my favorite koans, Zen stories, was the following. I'll tell it. A student comes to see his teacher, and with great enthusiasm, he quotes an ancient sage and says something like, "Heaven and earth and I are of one substance. The 10,000 things and I are not separate." Unquote. And the teacher says, pointing to a flower, "People of this world look at this flower as in a dream. So does the dream go on as we look at the flower? The dream about flowers and not seeing this directly. And can one see the difference between looking at the idea of a flower and just what's there, speaking so eloquently? Or new dreams evoked, I was already saying, poems coming to mind, Zen stories coming to mind. And therefore, a different mode, a switch into the mode of thinking and remembering and enthusing. The emotive states we can get ourselves into through poetry, goose pimples, etc. Or just look. With no motive stirring, because all the motives that have stirred have become transparent. And there it still is as it is. Why is it that even when there is some space in the mind, some open listening, thoughts slow down, relatively quiet, there always remains a residue of the self? The person continued asking, when you, Tony, talk about the self, like seeing a self-image arise and its effects, you talk about that. Do you see it directly arising at that moment in yourself? Or do you speak from memory? It's an interesting thing that the mind, when it is quiet, open, not invested in itself, in that network, we've talked about it, that whole complex network of self-investment, remembrances, anticipations, images, past experiences. The whole vast network that can be quiet in abeyance without energy, the energy being here, listening, looking. It's interesting that in that state of quiet, open awareness, it's possible to look at something remembered, at a memory. At the memory of a self-image arising and the either totally getting involved in it, which is the end of attention, and only waking up to the fact that there's involvement in self-image, is there, then that self-image and its involvement is already a recall, it's reverberating in memory, but it can be seen very clearly. That's what happened. Oh, it is happening, one thinks it's happening, but at the moment of attention, it's not happening, it's a memory. Next moment it may take over again. But that memory of self-image arising and involvement with it emotionally, either being hurt over, because this is what's brought up all the time, hurt over an insult or an accusation, criticism, or feeling flattered, praised, and the good feelings from that. This whole memory can be evoked right now and looked at. And looked at like at a flower. The flower itself right now, we can look at it in memory, can't we? This morning there were some black-eyed Susans on the table. Very eloquent. Just, one doesn't want to say shouting, but. So that can be looked at. Like a tree that's there. Or the floor, the dark holes in the floor and the wavy patterns around it. That's there. But closing the eye, there's still a memory of it that can also be looked at. Realizing this is the memory and opening the eyes, this is what is there. The other is the memory of it. And in so looking right now, is there a residue of self? It has to be quiet to really give attention. Is there or isn't there? And if there isn't, there isn't. Of course, someone can say, oh, it's hidden, it's in a deep layer. But there's no feeling of layers right now. There's a feeling of unlayered openness. With no feeling of separation from an idea of oneself or from people. Sound of the insects, that fine hum permeating everywhere, isn't it? Coolness of the air, the light. So, if what is found and felt is this seemingly everlasting residue of self, which is really, isn't it, some sense of separation, some sense of me-ness here as opposed to or separate from everything else over there or outside. Me here with my inside and something there on the outside of my inside. What is that? What is that in its subtlest substance or essence or movement? Can one listen ever so subtly to what is subtly separating? Not threatening it to listen so it may go away, one may be free of it. Maybe this is what this residue is, a subtle striving to be free. To be free like so-and-so, or one imagines that so-and-so is. A subtle protectiveness or defense, a holding on to what? What are we holding on to? Fear of dying? Is that there? Fear of not being? What is being? Investment in idea about myself? Is that being? Is that my existence? What I hope to be, hope to keep, hope to possess or have or become. This is all much grosser probably than what is going on. Because the attachment to existence is so subtle. Existence as one knows not what. Existing. But we are alive right this moment. Without any image or so, there is aliveness. What I mean to say is, it is not the image that provides aliveness and survival. It that provides an imaginary survival. And to that we're attached. The imaginary survival and continuity of myself as a story, a novel, volume 1, 2, 3, ad infinitum. There's tremendous attachment. We talked about it yesterday, didn't we, in this open meeting here. About wanting to wanting the heroes of one's favorite stories to live on and on forever. And a similar process is going on and wanting to live forever as a continuous story. And with that, the fear of this story coming to an end, or the thought about the story coming to an end, eliciting fear. Doesn't it? I think it doesn't for me anymore. It used to. I can well remember it. The thought, I won't be here anymore. I won't see this beautiful valley or the lovely mountains or be with people I love, I won't be with any of that would cause a twinge of pain or more than a twinge. At a moment when everything was there, the mountains were there, the people were there. For millions of years we were not here without mourning. We weren't here. And for a second we're here and we're afraid of going. Actually, this morning, a lot of people looked at the sunrise. It was incredible, wasn't it? Eloquent as a flower. The color of the sky, constantly changing, although I looked at that. In looking at it without any thought of change of color, it was always what it was. Only recall, remembering the more intense orange, would say, oh, it has changed. But just watching it the way it was always what it was, this moment. And it's often due to the gaps of attention that then looking again, there the color has changed. Oh, it has changed, we say. But if there was such a thing, which there is not to my knowledge, of constant awareness, constant attention, would there ever be a feeling of change? Or past, present, and future? That is created by thought, which happens when we're not watching, but thinking and speculating. And with thoughts about past, present, and future come all our fears and all of our imagined pleasures and longings. Can one even intellectually get a notion that without thinking about the future based on the past, there is a possibility to really be here without fear? Without that residue which needs recall. And it's not just the brain and thoughts that recall, the whole body has memory built into it, the organs, the muscles, glands, it's all invested with memory. But usually triggered by thought, remembrance through association cerebrally, or wherever all of this takes place. Somebody in one meeting, I didn't write it down, it just comes to mind now, said, what is this moment? What is it? Is that the hum of the motor, creaking of a bench, moving of a body, sound of incense, not incense, insects. Pulsating, whatever it is, this body, vibrating, pulsating, breathing. No thought of tomorrow or yesterday, clouding, dimming what's going on right now. No worrying what will happen to me or what good will befall me, good or evil. That is quiet. And what's the duration of this moment? I don't know. It lasts till the next instant of inattention. And when there's inattention, the habitual programs, the habitual automatic programs, kick in like automatic pilot. And then a waking up, and then one says, does one, oh, yeah, I'm finding myself in this moment. The plane is humming, the trees are rustling. Gently, warmly, aren't they? It's warm. But I'm speaking about it. In the listening, there needs to be no verbalization at all. We're doing this because it's a talk, we're communicating. We could sit here for an hour quiet, but we do that at other times. Talk and verbalization may have some indirect connection with seeing something directly. Not just thinking about it, but coming upon it. That's why talks continue, people. Tell me that. Suddenly something is seen directly in a talk or outside of it. But not just because of talks. This opening of the human mind to direct insight is the most unfathomable thing, a miracle, which I think no one has an explanation for or a technique for its happening. Because it just happens, it's there. This question came up in a group meeting. Can there ever be full awareness of thought as it is happening? Because we do say a lot, don't we? Watch the thought. Watch your thoughts, see. See them, not just also see the content. See the content of the thought at one glance, and that's possible. Very often in meditation practice, one is discouraged from becoming involved with the content of thought, and everyone knows why, because content of thought is almost instantly involving. But we know it from waking up from a dream, don't we, that at waking up, instantly the whole dream is seen at a glance. It's possible. Also from waking up from a daydream, a train of thoughts, to instantly see at one glance the whole content of the train. And it's important, I feel it's important for us to be acquainted with what it is that we're thinking about without passing judgment over it or necessarily analyzing it or if one is so inclined or needs to do this for reasons of one's own, then that's a different matter. But to just see at a glance and another glance throughout the day and week and years what it is thought is occupied with this is very interesting learning. Rather than just suppress the thought with a practice as soon as it arises or just say thinking, thinking, thinking. In order to get away from the content. And I'm not saying keep on thinking or get involved in the content, but see it at a glance. Maybe a verbalization will come up, oh, this is what I've been thinking about. And verbalizing it may make it more clearly understood. There are such practices recommended by some people to put into words what it is that one is thinking. To verbalize it, to make what is implicit and vague explicit and clear by verbalizing it. But it's not the same as seeing something at a glance because the verbalization may already add and edit edit in and edit out. So one has to experiment with all of this. We're our own free masters, are we? So can there ever be full awareness of thought as it is happening? When a thought happens, well, we have to say what we're talking about. Let's start with talking right now as I am. There's lots of thought about or recall of a flower, of the poem about Nansen and the student, what he said, recall, that's thought. But the awareness was open. Maybe not as full as when there's nothing, no talk taking place, nothing needs to be said or recalled or pointed out. And there's a quality of emptiness that of course is not there when examples are taken and things are recalled and thought is needed to put something into fairly clear terms. But it is possible for there to be an open mind. The birds are there, the insects, even though talking and some imaging is going on. And there's no feeling of separation. That's that kind of thought. Out of awareness, saying something, pointing something out, making something explicit. That kind of thought and verbal activity need not and does not close the open mind. The mind remains open and attentive. But in our everyday living, no matter how much one wants to catch that moment when one became inattentive, it's the very quality of inattention to happen when one is not paying attention. And then thinking takes place and there's no attention. Or maybe some partial awareness. Whatever that is, I don't know what it all is physiologically or brain function-wise, but there can be sort of partial attention of what it is one is thinking about, but the mind is more involved with what it is thinking about. It's not completely here. And then there is this, what I feel is an alternation between being attentive, attention being there, and then a thought train, and then attention and a thought train, or an image, which, because of its close succession, gives the feeling of simultaneity, as though one was aware of all the images and thoughts in the mind. But in really looking at image, it's not there anymore. There's attention. And image hooking into the emotions, there's not full attention, sometimes none. But what is possible, and which is beyond our doing, it happens miraculously, is that all of us wake up from dreaming days or nights, thinking, speculating, suddenly we wake up to the fact that, and what happened is still there on recall in the mind. It can be looked at. That's how we learn about what goes on in the mind, by these awakenings. And this is how we learn about ourselves, and in learning about ourselves, we learn about each other. And in learning about ourselves, we learn about each other, maybe in a gentle way, in a forgiving, open, loving way. the need to project onto others what we don't see in ourselves melts away when we do see what is going on in ourselves. We don't have to project it onto others anymore, but we can see it clearer both in ourselves and in others. With this we come to our last note here. Is it really possible to see our deeply programmed prejudices about people who are different from us? People of different color, different races, different ethnic traditions, different religions, different gender, gays and lesbians. I had a long discussion yesterday about that in a group. Can the idea that we're not prejudiced be a hindrance in seeing it operate? Because probably none of us here wants to be prejudiced and would like to not be prejudiced and may be very convinced that we have put that aside. And that may be a handicap in really seeing it operate. So how free are we to discover prejudice in ourselves against others who are different from us? Oh, where it is so deeply ingrained thinking about, what one has heard joking about, people of other races of joking about gays and lesbians. It's going to be very likely coming up here in this whole presidential campaign, which usually toward the end takes the low, dirty road, maybe already in the beginning, to appeal to prejudices in people to get elected by pointing to the other party or protecting or being in cahoots or friendly with the people of, with gay people, lesbians, or those who are black or whatever. And we were wondering whether the most important thing is not to meet each other as gays and lesbians, blacks, Afro and Asians, and to meet each other, to get together. One person talked about a judge, a Supreme Court judge, who made the decisive vote on some legislation against gays. He said he'd never known one. It turned out his law clerk was a gay person. And later, in order not to say this wrong, the person wrote me a note here so I don't misquote him or her. Let me just read this so it doesn't come out wrong. In the case of the Supreme Court Justice, who reportedly said regarding his vote in the decision I talked about yesterday, that he did not know anyone who was gay, I do not know if it is common knowledge that his own law clerk was gay. It seemed fairly common knowledge in Washington when I was working there. What I'm concerned about is, having made this statement without knowing if the person involved has let people know that he is gay himself. The justice has since said that he would today probably vote the other way, but he has not indicated in statements that I have seen that his former law clerk may have been somehow involved in his change of heart. This is showing me what care must be taken when one speaks. But what it also shows is we must meet each other. I've known people for many years and not know that they were gay or lesbians. It's only very relatively recent in my long life that I have known people who come to retreat who tell me. And in California there is a larger proportion of the people who are quite open about being gay and lesbian. It's so important for us to meet with each other and get this idea out of the mind that these are different people, not normal. It's deeply lodged. There's no fault finding in this. It's a fact. So can we openly reveal what we are to each other? I remember this very well from the days in Germany, being half Jewish. Was an ambiguous, two-sided thing. It was nice to say, I'm that, so that people who you were friends with knew, you're all right. It's all right to know somebody who's half Jewish. On the other hand, it was also nice to be concealed, so people would not have prejudice against you. Well, I must say that there were far more people who remained friendly than those who turned away and said, I can't associate with you anymore. There were those, but they were in the minority. So what all can we do alone and together to unearth what separates us and causes hatred? Because you could say again, I'm not putting words into anybody's mouth, hatred is also has a positive side. It relieves us of stored up, repressed, whatever. And I don't think anybody would say that. Maybe. I don't know. It does, but expression of hatred, it never empties the reservoir. It keeps on going. It feeds on itself. The feeling of power and relief once more of the same. Doesn't it? Maybe I'm wrong. There seems to be a need. I was amazed in Sweden this spring, driving. We had beautiful weather, something like this, clear and crisp and sunny. And the Swedes were absolutely beside themselves with exuberance over this weather. After 9 months of darkness almost, there was just joy and happiness and good feelings. And all along this highway that we drove up north to the retreat place, stopping for a rest station, we would see black swastikas on the railing or on the restroom, sometimes big on a rock. Now, I'm not saying it's absolutely littered with that, but it was visible many, many places in Sweden. One of the most ancient symbols. It symbolizes the sun bringing light. Mostly the other way around, not the way the Germans used it, but inverted. Maybe the Germans inverted it. But it's found on the most ancient engravings and caves. And now it is a symbol for togetherness and hatred. Hatred against not just the Jews, people, all these people of inferior races, and the gays and lesbians thrown in. Racial cleansing we hear about, or racial purification. All these ideas that this brain, this human mind is capable of. If we didn't have this capacity of a brain, that wouldn't happen. But since we have it, it does happen, and will we survive it? Maybe not. What kind of cleansing has to take place for all of these programs to come to light, to become transparent in their uselessness, their hurtfulness, their Is that what this work is about? It does have a far reach. Because we reach far. This brain is one human consciousness. Here in Sweden or in South Africa, Bosnia, Middle East, Far East, North, South, West, symbols and the delusion that symbols evoke, the emotions that they evoke, the rallying cry of the flags and symbols to band together against someone else, to feel a little better oneself. Is that it? I can't go into the analysis of it, but one can watch it in oneself. And a lot of it just coming out of sheer ignorance. Somebody was telling yesterday in a group that in walking through a park in which there's a lot of gay activity, she's telling her two sons walking there to be careful, that this was a dangerous place. This is how this whole thing evolved. And one person had just been engaged in studying, conducting a study, was informing all of us that attacks don't happen mostly by heterosexuals on children, not by homosexuals. We don't hear about that. We just hear these insinuations and rumors and fear-mongering things by people who don't know what they're doing either. So how will we inform ourselves and each other accurately so we can free ourselves and each other from these false, deadly assumptions? It's possible, isn't it? We can meet and talk with each other openly. And if hurt occurs or defensiveness, can that become transparent as creating barriers where there are no barriers, where there are only human beings, one human family is what we are. No matter how different we look or how different our behaviors or rituals or habits or customs may be, we're one human family, same organism, same processes, same pool of genes and stuff, DNA, whatever you all call it, that we draw upon. And the same functioning of a brain which can be quiet in wonderment or closed up in prejudice. Have to be ashamed. We don't have to be ashamed or guilty in finding prejudice in ourselves. It's a good day on which we find it. Is that what's needed too, to get off the guilt trip? To see that as another program running? And that prevents looking. Guilt and shame and blame. Fault finding. Rather than looking alone and together what moves us all, in what ways. And learn about it. And in the learning, maybe freeing ourselves from the tremendous domination of the programs which are wired on, whatever you call it, into this body-mind. So what are we? What are you and me and all of us at the moment of listening to the bird, looking at the flower, breathing in the fresh air and exhaling? Don't really know, do we? But that doesn't hinder aliveness. We will end here for today.